everyone. It is January 30th, 2020. Lucky you, you're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It is a Thursday. So have you been staying up late listening to the questions asked of the House managers and the president's attorneys during these impeachment hearings? Oh, I don't know about you, but I have. Anyway, so it's late nights, not very satisfying. And then I realized too much is happening around the world. Too much is happening that we should be focusing on, because I'm not sure that impeachment is going to get us what we need, which is the removal of Donald Trump. And that will explain in part why I grabbed my first guest. So while Mel Goodman is one of my absolute faves because he is my teacher of foreign policy, he explains to me the military-industrial complex. He had a recent piece at Counterpunch entitled The Media and the Military Mindset, which we will definitely get into. But given the fact that he's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins and a former CIA analyst, the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, a whistleblower at the CIA. I could go on and on and on, but he's also the national security columnist at Counterpunch. I called him up and I said, okay, before we get into your article at Counterpunch, you got to do something else. And he goes, what? And I said, you got to talk about the Middle East plan that was offered up by Bibi and the Donald on Tuesday. And I think you will be in agreement with me, Mel. It ain't a plan. So welcome
to
the program.
Rescue the political fortunes of both Bibi Netanyahu and Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is facing impeachment and needs to do something, and Netanyahu is facing jail, and he certainly needs to do something, and this is what this plan is all about. So this so-called deal of the century is a farce.
So let's talk. I mean, we've been, you know, we've been building up for it. Let's talk a little bit about who was at the table when this was written. Let's talk about the reaction to what was written. And since this is, I described it to you, as I told you, it was a Bibi wet dream, that this is everything that Bibi wants. He wants to deliver it in order to sort of protect him for the purposes of reelection, but that it is such an incredible farce, and how they can actually offer it with a straight face to me is both embarrassing, but it should tell you a little bit both about Bibi Netanyahu and Donald Trump.
Well, more importantly than who was at the table is who wasn't at the table.
Exactly.
And this goes back to one of the Sherlock Holmes mysteries about the dog that didn't bark was the clue. Well, the dog that didn't bark because it wasn't at the table was the Palestinian dog in this fight.
Right.
There were no Palestinians at the table. There were no Palestinians consulted. Trump has done everything he has been able to do to embarrass and humiliate the Palestinians ever since he took office. He's closed their offices in Washington. He's cut off aid packages for Palestinians. He has stopped UN efforts to assist Palestinians. He's recognized Jerusalem as a capital. There isn't anything that Trump hasn't been willing to do for Israel. And then he put three Zionists, including his prodigal son-in-law, Jared Kushner, in charge of creating the so-called peace plan. And this is what Jared and the U.S. ambassador to Israel have come up with. And it's a plan that really leaves the Palestinians totally encircled by Israel, by Israeli settlements, by Israeli sovereignty. So it is as far from a two-state solution, which every American administration has supported, as you can get. But the thing to remember is the Israelis have always gotten the best of any of these international plans.
Yes.
If you go back to the original British promise to establish a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, that was a time when Jews didn't even make up 10% of the population. And when you had the partition by the United Nations right after World War II, again, the Jews made up less than a third of the population, but they got the majority of the land. And after the 67 war, Israel conquered what was left of Palestine, essentially, when they took over the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, and, of course, the West Bank. So in some ways, the Trump plan is a departure from what other administrations have done, both Republicans and Democrats. But for 100 years, it's Israel that's really benefited from any of the Western interventions into the Middle East. And this is really no exception.
So in this one article that I was looking at Slate.com, they wrote, Kushner and Netanyahu might believe or hope that once the Palestinians realize they have nowhere to go, no allies to rally for solidarity, they'll swallow hard and take the deal. So let's talk about the rest of the Middle East community. How did they respond to this piece of paper?
I mean, well, the interesting thing about the response to me is the lack of response.
Yeah.
And you really haven't seen any Arab support for the Palestinians, particularly over the last 10 years. And when you think about the Middle East is engaged really in a 40-year war cycle, going back to the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980. There have been a series of wars in the Middle East. And I think the current situation now, which is new and different, is the Arab states may be concerned that the United States is going to pull out of the Middle East completely. This is what Trump is talking about. This is what he would like to do. And that the only ally they would have against Iran, the Persian state, would be Israel. So it's interesting to me how quiet the Arab states have been, particularly over this so-called peace plan, which is anything but a peace plan. So I think for the Palestinians, I can't think of greater frustration than they're feeling now. They've been humiliated by the Israelis, humiliated by Donald Trump, and they've been distanced, essentially, by Arab states that have really been very unwilling to do much for the Palestinians to begin with. And when you look at the current leader of the West Bank in terms of Abbas, this is someone who is willing to make compromises for peace. And we know that from secret documents as well as public documents. And Abbas has been totally humiliated by this. So there will be no Palestinian state. There will be a series of Palestinian enclaves that will be surrounded by walls and borders and Israeli troops and Israeli police. You will have the apartheid that I think has been in Israel for a long time that Israelis have always denied exists. But I think with this so-called plan, you can no longer deny the apartheid system in which the Palestinians are, I won't call them lesser citizens, but they're lesser individuals within the Israeli empire in the Middle East. So this is a very sad turn of events.
So let me just, I want people to understand a little bit about the terms here, because this is from The Guardian. In Trump's vision, which might as well have been brought up by Netanyahu himself, Palestinians are offered a truncated and dismembered archipelago of Bantustans, whatever that term is, connected by bridges and tunnels and subservient to the Israeli state, which will retain security control over the entirety of the land. The Israelis will keep all of Jerusalem. No Palestinian refugees will be able to return to their homes. But wait, there's more. Palestinians will only receive this excuse for an offer, which fails to meet even basic human rights, once they satisfy several conditions proving that they are ready for statehood. I mean, it is almost like they're pouring salt into every wound. There's not a level of compassion or understanding in here. In fact, the more hurtful it is, the more it seems to be celebrated by Bibi and Donald Trump.
Yeah, and the incredible thing about this, for the right wing in Israel, the ultra-Orthodox, this plan doesn't even go far enough. So Netanyahu, ironically, might have trouble forming a coalition if he should win this election in March. He's failed to win the last two elections. Trump is desperate to reelect Netanyahu. He's offered him everything along the way or along these various election paths, including a U.S. base in Israel, U.S. Mutual defense agreements with Israel. He does anything he can for Netanyahu. That's what this peace plan is all about. But as The Guardian says, this is a state, well, you can't call it a state. It's an interconnected chunks
yes.
of territory
yes.
Inside of the West Bank.
But they're connected by tunnels.
These chunks will contain Jewish settlements that will be encircled by Palestinian land. So the Palestinians will giving up any claims they have to the West Bank land. They don't get any rights to Jerusalem. They've been offered a suburb outside of East Jerusalem as the so-called capital, the so-called Palestinian capital of this new truncated formation. And they're told that if they're good over the next 4 years and form a democratic state, unlike any kind of state that exists in the Arab Middle East, they can expect $50 billion in aid money from the West. And this is what Kushner's been holding out. This is that conference he had not too long ago.
Yeah.
That maybe Bahrain and Oman and the United Arab Emirates supported, and they attended this announcement of this so-called peace plan. But this is just a kick in the pants to any Palestinian who thought there was a chance for some negotiated agreement with Israel.
And understand, in the United States, who likes this other than Sheldon Adelson? And is obviously the evangelical community in the United States as well. They also see this as something that's positive. So this is also for Donald Trump's reelection. He's massaging a group of Jewish voters. He's also massaging the evangelical base here. So both of them see this as a benefit, not to Israel, not to Palestine, but to their reelection. In
it's
a lot of ways,
reelect Donald and to keep Bibi out of jail.
Yeah,
that's what this plan is all about.
Oh, my God. It's a get-out-of-jail card. All right. Let me, before we get into your discussion, which is wonderful at Counterpunch, about the media and the military, there was an article that I saw at Task and Purpose. I actually posted it on Facebook this week, and it was from 7 days ago. The Pentagon shifted $35 trillion worth of budget funds last year. They were moving $35 trillion around within the Pentagon budget. I just want people to understand the enormity of that amount and what we don't know. Because I said, this is where our tax dollars go to die, literally and figuratively.
Well, I think what we do know is that we've been lied to about the defense budget throughout the Cold War, the post-Cold War period.
Right.
We're spending more on defense now when we're essentially not in a major wartime situation, but we're spending more on defense in terms of gross amounts than we did during wars, say the Korean War and the Vietnam War.
Right.
We've been lied to about what these costs are all about. There's only been one audit of the Pentagon in this whole period. The Pentagon failed that audit. The figure for defense that I use is not only what we spend at the Pentagon, what we spend for weapons and personnel, but you have to include the intelligence community's budget. 70% of that goes to the military.
Mm-hmm.
You have to include a good part of the Department of Energy's budget, which goes to nuclear weapons, guarding and designing nuclear weapons. You have to take into account the Veterans Administration, which will be paying generations of benefit money to veterans who fought in these fool's errands, these unwinnable wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And finally, you have to add a good part of the Department of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
When you do that, the defense budget is really probably $1.5 trillion, which was more than the entire world spends on defense. Now, have we gotten real defense out of this? No. We've gotten losing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Add Vietnam to the list of losing wars. The more inept we become in terms of real defense, the more money the Pentagon gets to spend. And as we learned most recently with the Inspector General's report from Afghanistan, just as we were lied to about Vietnam, lied to about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, we've been lied to about Afghanistan and what we've spent
the
Afghanistan
papers. Yes.
The kind of money we've thrown away, which may be as much as $2 trillion in Afghanistan, and you add over $1 trillion to Iraq. Think what we could have done domestically with that kind of funding in terms of infrastructure, in terms of education, in terms of Medicare for all, in terms of at least some comprehensive health program that builds on Obamacare. These are things that could have been done if we weren't buying weapons, some of which have no real utility. We're developing an aircraft carrier now, the Ford-designed aircraft carrier that will cost over $1 billion, when we know it will have no utility if there's a threat with regard to China, say, in Asia, because they've developed very cheap cruise missiles that would force carriers to go out of range to hit Chinese targets. So we're building weapon systems that make no real sense, but this is what the military-industrial complex wants. And when you look at the big firms such as Lockheed Martin,
Raytheon,
and Northrop Grumman, these are firms which retired generals are staffing high-level positions. These are firms that are lobbying on the Hill and giving huge amounts of money to particularly Republican senators and congressmen who vote for these weapon systems. But another ugly truth of all of this is these defense bills get bipartisan support.
Yes.
You don't really have Democrats putting up.
Well, and you don't have a media. I mean, as I was reading your article, I kept saying to myself, screaming, going, so who's going to tell us the truth? Because, you know, you assume that you're going to get, you know, you're going to get the military-industrial complex message from Trump News or Fox News. But then you go through, and this is why this article is just so important, you go through who you hear on CNN. You go through who you hear on MSNBC. You go through who the New York Times goes to. And it just becomes this vicious cycle. They're massaging their other, you know, they leave the military, but then where do they go? They go work for the military-industrial complex, and nobody ever shares their conflict. What is the biggest argument now for why we're in this impeachment? Because of the fact that Hunter Biden, while his father was tasked with Ukraine, was working for this energy company in Ukraine. And oh my God, the conflict of interest, the appearance of impropriety. Your whole article is about impropriety. That's what this is all about.
And it's not just the military. If you look at the reporting that you get on network television, say on the intelligence community, and particularly the CIA, look at MSNBC, that is supposed to be the
exactly.
liberal side of the media front in terms of the corporate media. Well, MSNBC uses regularly two former CIA officials. One is John Brennan, who is the CIA director who broke into the Senate computers to compromise the Senate report on torture and abuse. And the other one is John McLaughlin. John McLaughlin was George Tenet's deputy in 2002-2003, wrote that phony speech that Secretary of State Colin Powell gave at the United Nations in February of 2003 to convince an international community and a domestic community that we needed to go to war against Iraq. He used 28 allegations, every one of them false, every one of them written or endorsed or orchestrated by John McLaughlin, who's a major spokesman on MSNBC. So wherever you turn in terms of reporting on the defense establishment in what I call really a national security state, these are military or intelligence spokesmen, and these networks never tell you the conflict of interest. A former student of mine at the National War College, Admiral James Stavridis, he's a regular on CNN.
Right.
CNN never tells you that he works for one of these contractors, and he's one of the conduits for getting defense money into these defense think tanks and these defense contractors. So it's a system that is totally corrupt. Elizabeth Warren has addressed it, and Bernie Sanders, to a certain degree, has addressed the bloated defense budget. But it doesn't come up in the debates. It doesn't come up in the political discussion. And I think liberal politicians are somewhat intimidated and afraid to take on the military, afraid to take on the intelligence community.
Because there is no echo chamber for that message. You know that. What you were just describing about what you hear on MSNBC, what you hear on CNN, the people they go to at the New York Times, it just continues to massage that message of that you know, from the military perspective and the industrial complex perspective, but it doesn't offer any. So as you are looking at all these outlets, is there any outlet that ever has the spine to bring someone up who could, in fact, be critical with knowledge? I never see a Mel Goodman, for example, but I'm just kind of curious, Mel, is there anyone that you see that we can ever even point to that would actually be able to articulate the message that you're describing that never gets shared? And I do want to say a pox on MSNBC. If, you know, they keep talking about the fact and they package themselves as being so open and progressive and liberal and transparent, but how do you have transparency when you don't share with your audience, oh, by the way, he also works for them?
Well, we see this regularly. The difficult thing is for any kind of a contrarian or a dissident or a whistleblower to get his say in public media. That's why, well, talk radio, what you do is extremely important, and what organizations, online organizations such as Counterpunch.org, what they do in terms of getting dissident and contrarian voices out there. We need to discuss both sides of the issue. And when Eisenhower issued his warning about the military-industrial complex in 1961, which we certainly have. He also warned us that when you're in a state of permanent war, which we have been in this country since 2001, then you also start to lose personal liberty. You lose civil liberties. And we've seen that regularly, which is another price that we're paying for this kowtowing to the defense establishment and these bloated defense budgets.
So,
and we see this regularly.
So
when you have genuine whistleblowers, and I know the cases of Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning are very complicated, but the fact of the matter is Edward Snowden did point to crimes that were violations of the Constitution in terms of massive surveillance that led to rewriting of some of the laws, and even someone such as former Attorney General Eric Holder called Edward Snowden a public servant. But you never get that kind of discussion in the press about what did Snowden really contribute? What did Chelsea Manning really contribute? And I think this is one of the reasons why you need whistleblowers in the first place.
In the media, a whistleblower that blows and the media doesn't reflect it is not a whistleblower. You and I both know that the power of the whistleblower with his impeachment is that there was an incredible echo chamber and it was an opportunity to target Donald Trump. So, of course, that whistleblower gets celebrated. The whistleblowers you're described, they disappear. They get shuffled to the back of the room or the back of the bus. I have to MC an event at Rhode Island College in about 2 months. And one of the questions is now about how do we address these issues? How do we elevate people's understanding about these endless wars, especially when we have a voluntary military? So the same people are fodder over and over and over again. It doesn't touch us. But even as you say, we're spending, you know, trillions of dollars that are now draining our healthcare system and draining our environmental system and draining our infrastructure. We're putting it into a bomb instead of a road. What do you recommend as we sort of reevaluate whether the voluntary military has been aiding and abetting the story you've just told?
Well, the voluntary military is certainly part of the corruption, but that's exactly what Richard Nixon knew in 1972, 1973, when he abolished the draft. He knew if he abolished the draft, he would get the parents and the grandparents of these kids who were being called up to stop going out on the street to protesting the wars.
Exactly.
And so you haven't really had an anti-war movement in this country since the draft was abolished. And along with the absence of a anti-war community, you haven't really had a pro-arms control and disarmament community, a serious lobby.
Right.
Look at what has done to arms control and disarmament, which is sort of the collateral damage here that we're talking about. You had George W. Bush abrogate the anti-ballistic missile treaty, and now we're building a strategic missile defense system that doesn't work. And you had Trump come along and abolish the intermediate-range nuclear forces treaty, and now we're seeing a new kind of arms race in tactical weaponry that's going to cost even more billions of dollars. So all this, to me, is part of a piece which I label the dangerous national security state, where Americans don't really concern themselves with these defense issues. They sort of think it's enough to thank servicemen for their service, which
exactly.
I think is genuinely cynical and insincere. And meanwhile, less than 1% of American families feed their young men and young women into the military to fight these fool's errands that politicians have gotten us into. When you think of the wars in Vietnam and the lies we were told, the war in Iraq and the lies we were told about weapons of mass destruction, the Afghanistan papers, which exposed all the lies about Afghanistan, where we're still throwing away hundreds of billions of dollars.
And again,
so it's a never-ending cycle.
Again, your line from your piece, the United States is largely in an arms race with itself. But the media typically ignore bloated defense spending. One last point, because we talked about it, and you mentioned this, too, with Martin Luther King's address at the Riverside Church in 1967, and he linked chronic domestic poverty and military adventurism. So I'm going to end with this. I saw an article the other day, Mel Goodman, and the article was, because of the voluntary military, how do they get people to enlist? They offer them free health care. They offer them an opportunity to pay for education or something, whatever it is. So you know who is threatened by the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warren? The people that support the voluntary military. Because if all of a sudden we have health care for all, Medicare for all, guess what? Why enlist? If all of a sudden we have free college, why enlist? So there is another subtext here that, believe it or not, it turns out those that want to continue this bloated military budget are incredibly opposed to a Bernie and Elizabeth, not just because of, you know, the kind of capitalism we're talking about in the military-industrial complex, but because it's what they offer these young men and women to join. Suddenly, they will have an option other than the military. And that, to them, is terrifying.
And one other insidious aspect of this, since we're only a couple days away from the Super Bowl, all the publicity I've seen is how the United States Air Force is going to provide the security for the Super Bowl. So here, again, this is a way of co-opting the public about
exactly
what the military does for you. They're going to allow you to have your holiday on Super Bowl Sunday, because you can go to the game, you can
and they're
relax,
going to protect you.
And the Air Force will protect you.
And we're now
in a mood of thinking that we need this kind of protection from the military, so that's why we give in to the military.
Exactly. Mel Goodman, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy, Professor of Government at Johns Hopkins University, and the National Security Columnist for Counterpunch.org. You better read Counterpunch. Thank you so much for joining me, Mel.
Thank you, Arnie. Always good to be with you.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1992. That was the day the gravediggers of Chicago ended their 43-day strike. The United Press International's headline declared, "The dead will rest in peace now that Chicago area gravediggers have reached a tentative contract." The gravediggers were part of Service Employees International Union Local 106. The strike started on December 20th when workers at four Chicago area cemeteries walked off the job. At issue was wages, overtime, and health benefits. 22 other local cemeteries then locked out their workers. With the gravediggers on strike and locked out, more than 1,000 burials were delayed. The Chicago Rabbinical Society was able to get a court order for some of the burials to go forward due to Orthodox Jewish practice that requires burial within 24 hours. By the time the strike was settled, 300 burials were still waiting. Unless there is a labor dispute, grave digging is work that does not often find itself in the headlines. It is one of the many unsung types of labor that it takes to keep a big city like Chicago operating. In 1974, the famous radio host Studs Terkel published a book based on oral histories he had conducted with working people over the course of 3 years. The title of the book was simply Working. The book featured interviews that ranged from jazz musicians to pharmacists, farmers to welders. One of the most poignant interviews was with a gravedigger named Elmer Ruiz. Ruiz said, "I usually wear myself some black sunglasses. I never go to a funeral without sunglasses. It's a good idea because your eyes is the first thing that shows when you have a big emotion. Always these black sunglasses."
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2017, California wildfires cost insurance companies $13 billion. That's $4 billion more than the cost of the prior 10 years combined. In 2018, the cost grew even higher. Dave Jones, a former insurance commissioner of California, says these skyrocketing costs affect homeowners.
When risks get too extreme for insurance companies, they do two things. One is they raise the price of their product to reflect that risk. And second, they begin to write less insurance for that risk.
So many Californians now struggle to afford their premiums. And in some cases, insurance companies are refusing to renew homeowner policies. People can buy fire insurance from the state as a last resort. But to cover other risks to a home, they need to buy homeowners insurance on top of that.
So it's expensive, and some lower-income homeowners aren't going to be able to afford it.
Jones says as global warming leads to more deadly fires,
we are marching steadily towards an uninsurable future with regard to wildfire risk.
So some people whose homes are damaged or destroyed by a wildfire will be unable to rebuild. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Watch me walking out the door. Believe me, I'll make it. Believe me, I'll make it.
Would I lie to you, honey? This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes is on. He's actually a friend died, so I have two fabulous people sitting in for him. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Stephanie. But would I lie? You know what? I just decided. Here's my idea. Donald Trump is going to be doing a rally, I believe, in Iowa, maybe before the caucus. He's doing it in Iowa the day of the primary. I think that my side should be playing that song as his bus or whatever it is, caravan drives in. Would I lie to you, honey? Wouldn't that be hilarious? Like, have it booming with boom boxes everywhere. I think that would be the best political theater. Well, he'll either agree with me or disagree with me. But if it is Thursday, it is Stefan Schmidt. If it is Stefan Schmidt is a professor of political science at Iowa State, also affectionately known as Dr. Politics. This will be the last time we chat. And then after that, it'll be the Iowa caucus, because it is happening next week. Oh, my God. We've been talking about it and counting down the days forever, Stefan. I can't believe it's really here.
It's here. It is this year going to apparently be the biggest caucuses maybe in history in terms of Democratic turnout. I mean, yeah. People really are pretty interested and excited, and the Democratic Party has been training their caucus, precinct officers and recruiting huge numbers of volunteers. So it's going to be wonderful. And I think Air Force One just flew over my farmhouse because President Trump is speaking tonight at 7 o'clock.
Oh, God, just like the Super Bowl. I can't stand it.
And
Air Force
and
One is...
The people have been sleeping out, and this is Iowa, and it's winter.
Yep.
And there's snow, and they've been sleeping out in front of the convention center
waiting for
in their lawn chairs and stuff. It's going to be another record-breaking crowd.
We know that Trump is looking for anything for a distraction. This is an opportunity. It's also a way to step on the message of the caucus, because so many of the people that are running are stuck at the impeachment hearings and they can't get to the caucus, which obviously leaves it open for like really three people: Buttigieg, Biden, and Trump. I mean, that's who has the landscape to them. But before we get into a little bit, Iowa State University just did a poll. What I thought was fascinating about the poll isn't just who's on first, who's on second, but there is a part of your poll that I thought was really, really interesting. And that was a part where the survey looks at a graph of the candidates that voters do not want to win the nomination. So you do both the yin and the yang. Who do they want? But who actually gets the highest level of, I don't want this person to win no matter what? So why don't you share both numbers with us? Because I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a good poll. It really is wonderful. It's done every single month. The same group of Democrats are polled, and then we track their changing views of things. And so in this latest one, which just came out yesterday at 5 a.m. in the morning, Bernie Sanders is clearly ahead, and he is the first choice. He is the second choice for almost all of the others. So yeah. Elizabeth Warren came in second, which was a surprise, and it was an even bigger surprise that Pete Buttigieg came in third. Joe Biden was fourth.
Right.
That was, I think, a little bit shocking.
Right. But what's so interesting is that it shows it's so fluid for second place. Bernie's got a big chunk second. Elizabeth got a big chunk second. Pete's for virtually all the same. Actually, the largest second was for Joe Biden, which I thought was interesting, that he has actually more votes for second than he does for coming in first, which should speak volumes to him. And the people that you see, people are kind of curious about, clearly Mayor Pete still has a level of curiosity. Amy Klobuchar has exactly what she wants. You can see her growing each month, but clearly she also has people paying attention to her. I think what was really fascinating was I saw something that Joe Biden said the other day. He's really ticked off at Mayor Bloomberg. And he thinks that Mayor Bloomberg is there as the stalking horse for him, basically hoping he fails. He also then accuses Mayor Bloomberg of helping Bernie Sanders. Do you believe that?
Oh, Yeah. Now the sharp knives have started coming out.
Oh, totally.
You know, everybody has been behaving themselves more or less,
totally.
Except for Hillary Clinton, you know, and
yeah.
Bernie. And
she's being
and
authentic,
Bernie and
Hillary.
Warren. But, you know, now they're starting to basically slice each other. And there's also this game going on where some of the candidates are quietly approaching the supporters of other candidates who probably will not make it out of here on caucus night in yeah. first, second, or third place. Yeah. And they're saying, hey, in your precinct, if you're not a viable group, will you support my candidate?
They're poaching.
And so, that, you know, that's possible because you go in, you have to declare who you're going to support in
right.
the Democratic caucuses this year. You can't just go in and then make up your mind. You have to write it down. But if your candidate doesn't have 15%, then the supporters of your candidate are allowed to go and support others. And so there's that negotiation going on behind the scenes.
Well, I think I would take in your poll with me into the caucus because I just want everyone to know that the graph that shows the candidates and voters do not want to win the nomination, who comes in number one? Am I correct? Isn't it Joe Biden?
I've got it right in front of
yeah,
me.
I think
by
it's,
a lot.
By a lot. So Joe then, Biden. Then,
yeah,
oh, my God.
Right.
This is
and
amazing.
Second is Tulsi Gabbard.
No surprise.
But unfortunately, Bernie Sanders is third.
Right. Which shows, but it, you know what it shows? It shows the progressive moderate divide. I mean, that really is, it's in stark
yeah.
relief. But what I think
yeah.
is unbelievable, and frankly, Mike Bloomberg is going to hold that chart up going, you see how damaged he is. And one of the
yeah.
reasons why Bloomberg, I think, will say this is let's go back to 2016. In 2016, who turned out to be the highest negatives ever? Donald Trump had the highest negatives going into a presidential campaign ever, and Hillary Clinton had the highest negatives going into a campaign ever. Not
yeah.
that Biden is really the equivalent of Hillary Clinton, but I hate to say, you know, as you're listening to the Republicans in this
right.
impeachment trial, they have spent a hell of a lot of time sharing too much information that the Democrats have not been forthcoming about Hunter Biden and Ukraine.
Yeah, I think, you know, that could very well, if Biden, you know, actually really starts generating enough support, could become an issue with Democrats.
It's an issue with me.
No.
Stefan, do you know why it's an issue with me?
But you're a passionate political
no, no,
activist
no, no, no,
who
no, no,
reads
no.
and listens to
no,
everything.
No. Here's the nugget of information, and I think this is one of the reasons why it was so important that John Kerry come out and endorse Joe Biden, and that John Kerry would actually be a fill-in for Biden across the campaign trail. It turns
yeah.
out that Joe Biden married the Hines, the woman who was the Senator Hines' wife. They have a child, the Hineses do, and this kid went to work with Hunter Biden. Okay, so he's related by marriage to
yeah.
John Kerry.
Yeah.
And when he saw what Hunter was doing by making a decision to work for this oligarch in Ukraine, he quit the firm. Now,
yeah.
what does that tell you about somebody that understood the appearance of impropriety, that thought it didn't make sense, that thought it would damage him politically, that thought it would damage his father, his stepfather, John Kerry? He processed all this and said, this sucks. This is bad news. If you're going to do this, I'm going to quit the firm. That's why it was so important. And I want John Kerry to answer the question, why did your stepson know this was wrong, and why did Hunter Biden not?
So let me get this straight, okay?
All right, I'm just telling you.
Republicans are okay with
no.
Donald Trump, whose kids are involved in every kind of thing that, you know, seems a conflict of interest.
That's
He's
right.
got a hotel in Washington, D.C.
Right.
that is a huge conflict of interest. The Republicans are okay with that, but Democrats are not okay with
let me tell you the difference. Okay, so Democrats want transparency. Republicans do not. Democrats
yeah.
want to make sure that there's some control on money in campaigns. Republicans do not. Democrats believe that we should pay for things with taxes and invest in services. Republicans want deregulation and wants nobody to pay, so you starve. You're on your own, Jack. Guess what? Democrats process differently, and that may
yeah.
include things like good government. That may include things like the appearance of impropriety. That means that you behave better. I have a different standard. Hallelujah.
Oh, and Bill Clinton's real estate deals and things were an aberration then, right?
Oh, my God. Trust me.
Democrats, in that moment, Democrats were not so interested in...
And you know why? Because let me tell you who those Democrats were. Those Democrats were new Democrats. What we have seen since the election of Bill Clinton is GOP light. We have seen new Democrats that wanted to make sure that Goldman Sachs was part of their administration, that wanted to make sure that they massaged Wall Street and deregulated derivatives, that wanted to make sure that whatever Republicans wanted welfare reform, Bill Clinton delivered welfare reform. Just look at the military policy. The military policy of Bush-Cheney is virtually identical to Barack Obama and Joe Biden. So, you know, what's happening now is truly about a choice. And it's interesting. It's not a choice between Democrats and Republicans. It's a choice between Democrats and Democrats, because before that, we were not given a choice. And I think that's one of the reasons why the story of Joe Biden, the fact that he has such high negatives, isn't because he's been there forever. It's because they look at some of the decisions he made and they realize in the new Democratic Party, those decisions don't sit well.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I probably differ a little, because voters still went and voted for Barack Obama, even though some of my most left-wing friends...
I voted
really
for Barack
the
Obama.
Fact that he was... Well, I know, but my left-wing friends here in Iowa hated the fact that he was taking campaign contributions from Wall Street and rich people. They said they shouldn't take any money from corporations. So the Obama administration was the last one where... Obviously, he got elected twice. Democrats were okay with those kinds of things,
yep.
with mass deportations yep. and so on. And after Obama left the White House, now a whole new generation of Democrats are not okay with those things. Right.
Well, let me just say something. I've never been okay with those things. This is such a wonderful story. Bill Curry is the former candidate for governor and he actually was an advisor to Bill Clinton. And he says, here's what's so interesting, is that while progressives lay a line out there about what they want, whether it's health care, whether it's the environment, whether it's tax policy, they will hold their nose and support moderates. They will do that. In fact, in 2018, progressives brought out new people. Even when they didn't win the nomination in the primary, they made sure that they stayed in the race. You are hearing that now. Bernie Sanders will not walk away if he loses the nomination. He better read the Riot Act to his base, and I think he will, because he understands what a detriment Donald Trump is, not just to the United States, but to the world. He is harmful to the planet. And I think it's really important that whatever Bernie says, wins, or does, he reminds people it is not just about us. It is about how toxic he is to the stability of the planet.
So if Joe Biden gets the nomination,
I will say the same thing.
What should Democrats do?
What they should do is they should hope that he really is going to be able to take it to Donald Trump in the debates, or whether Donald Trump is going to wipe him up. That's going to be my biggest fear. He keeps talking about how Donald Trump is afraid of him. No. Donald Trump thought a year and a half ago that he had to worry about Joe Biden because Joe Biden was polling well. Frankly, he probably has regrets about Ukraine, because he probably thinks that Joe Biden is one of the weaker candidates. But when he was looking at the numbers, Joe Biden appeared to be one of the stronger candidates. That's his regret about Ukraine. The reason he was even there was because of this illusion of a polling number that turns out today is not so significant.
Yeah, I hear you. I think you've got something there. I also wanted to mention Elizabeth Warren is running an absolutely fantastic ad now in Iowa. I don't
know
if she's running it in New Hampshire.
No, what's her ad?
It's an ad that features her two brothers and a nephew in Oklahoma, and a picture of her dad who was a janitor.
Right.
And the brothers, they are just like any Iowan living in a small town. They are the most wonderful, likable old guys, and they say the nicest things about her. It's a really touching ad. It's terrific. And she contrasts herself, obviously, with Trump, with that ad. It's a lovely ad.
Well, and not only that, but she also then does the interesting straddle. And that is that what is Amy's message? When I think of one word about Amy, the word that comes into my head is Midwest. She constantly talks about her, you know, hardscrabble background. She talks about coming from Minnesota and what her father had to do, yada, yada, yada. And now what you see is what Elizabeth Warren did was she stepped on Amy's message. Because guess what? She's even more West. She's Oklahoma. Talk about hard scrabble. She's rock hard scrabble. So she also does that. And so one of the things I think is interesting about that is look at where I started. Aren't I an example of the American dream? I can come from nothing in Oklahoma with brothers who, you know, served in the military, and their sister ended up becoming a Harvard professor and a U.S. senator. It's not that I was born a Harvard professor, but don't you want your kid to become one?
Well, we had a president like that already recently.
And are you referring to Barack Obama?
And his name was Barack Obama. He came from, you know, basically raised by a single mom, a dad who disappeared in Africa somewhere. And, of course, the Republicans wanted to see the transcripts, and they wanted to know how
and the birth certificate.
This kid could have gotten. Well, the birth certificate, of course. But I don't think Elizabeth Warren is going to have a birth certificate problem. But, you know, the whole idea, you know, how did you get to Harvard? Well, it's because you said you were a Native American, right? That's the narrative right,
right
now.
Right, but that doesn't work.
So this
is so interesting. I remember teaching giving a speech at Simmons College in Massachusetts. The conversation about affirmative action, which is what they're suggesting that Elizabeth Warren did, was she played the affirmative action card by suggesting she had Native American roots. So at the table that I was sitting at, listen to this. There was about, I think, 7 women of color and 3 women that were Caucasian like myself. And the women of color were the most angry about affirmative action. And I said, why? And they said, because when we walk into the room and we are an executive vice president or we are one of the top in management, the assumption about us is we're not qualified.
No.
Not that we went to Harvard. Not that we went to Yale. Not that we didn't have a 3.9 GPA, whatever it is. They said they automatically assume that we got there because of the color of our skin and not because of our ability and talent. And it's so interesting. They were the ones that were the most resentful because it wasn't just about opening doors. It was about packaging resentment.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, in academia now, there is very much a tremendous pressure to fill any opening, any position with usually with a minority or a woman if there is no minority. White men are the last on the list.
You're seeing that on TV.
You should be looking at, which is interesting.
But let's be honest, you're seeing it on TV. If you look at the panel on MSNBC 4 years ago, and then you look at the panels on MSNBC today, what do you notice? It is incredibly diverse. There are not only more women, there are more people of color. Sometimes it's all women. Sometimes it's mostly women of color. It's so amazing. That did not exist, but they're bending over backwards to show this diversity, which I think is great. It's not that these people are not qualified. That's the kicker. But nobody noticed. Nobody gave a crap. So let's talk one more thing. Since you're in Iowa and the caucus is coming up, the coronavirus is happening at the same time. The coronavirus right now has exploded past the numbers that we saw with SARS. We know that the spread of it is incredibly rapid. There have been a handful of cases that have been diagnosed in the United States, but I believe they're about to call it a worldwide pandemic. They don't know how to fix it. As someone said, in some ways it's worse than Ebola in the sense that with Ebola, you know you die. With this, you may not, which means it's almost easier for the transmission. But what it also is going to do is also challenge us as a country as to whether we are prepared to deal with this kind of pandemic. One, it raises questions about our public health system, which sucks because it's never been supported by anyone. It also is going to raise questions about our healthcare system. And as I posted something about coronavirus, here's what I suggested that people do. You better check out what your copay is, what your deductible is, and whether when you need to get treated, you're in network. And I'm wondering whether they're using what's happening with the coronavirus as part of the sort of final conversation about the healthcare piece that is the tension between the Mayor Pete's and the Bernie's and the Elizabeth Warren's and the Joe Biden's.
No, they're not. They're not using that at all for some reason. It's really silly. And, of course, the Trump administration is closing down, or maybe already has closed down, those really advanced quarantine hospital facilities that were put in place with Ebola.
Yes.
So if this thing turns out to be a serious problem, those places have been shut down. And so we just don't think ahead. You know, we don't plan ahead. We want the private sector to do it. And it doesn't, it's not interested. It's too expensive. So the Mexicans are really angry at the Corona virus because their biggest beer is called Corona. So they're changing the name from Corona to Ebola beer.
Oh no! Oh no!
No, it's a joke.
I know you are. I know you are. But you were absolutely right. You pointed out that Trump had cut funding to the hospitals that deal with these lethal diseases. The other thing is, in 2018, there was a group within, I think, the Defense Department that was supposed to look at the security issues from these kind of global illnesses. Okay, they got rid of that strategic group. It was disbanded in 2018, and according to Stephanie, he has just recreated a variation on that theme, Donald Trump, today for what he disbanded in 2018. Not only do they basically get rid of the hospitals, they got rid of the group that was supposed to be focusing on this. What does this tell you about not only our lack of preparedness, but you know what? Doing this at the last minute isn't going to deal with the fact that we have so many holes in our healthcare system. How do we deal with that?
Well, we do. And we think that healthcare should largely be private insurance, and public health comes sort of second or third, and that's normally a really bad idea. You know, you have to have a really robust, deep, and wide public health system. And the whole idea of not giving immigrants any access who are here illegally and you know, don't qualify for Medicaid or Medicare, not giving them access to health care is such a mind-blowing insanity. You know, immigrants come, if they get sick and it spreads, it doesn't spread only among immigrants, right? It spreads to everyone. So
well, it's worse than that.
Everybody's interest.
No, it's worse than that. So you're talking about the undocumented who don't have access to health care. Just this week, I believe it was, the Supreme Court came down with the public charge rule, which basically says if you are here legally, you could be denied both permanent status, a green card, or even citizenship if you access services. So if you need health care, you're legally here, everyone. You're paying taxes here, everyone. Everything about you is legitimate, except you're not a citizen. Now, because of the public charge rule, you are going to see legal immigrants afraid to access the healthcare system. That's just evil. That's evil.
It's absolutely incomprehensible.
It is.
Incomprehensible. It really is.
And as you were talking, I just got handed from Stephanie. This is from the New York Post. Of course, the Post wants to make sure that they inform their conservative voters how good Trump is. White House creates task force to monitor the deadly coronavirus. This at the same time as in 2018, they got rid of the task force that was supposed to look at these kinds of viruses. I want someone to put a split screen and put the New York Post article at the top, and then right next to it, put the 2018 headline where they got rid of the same exact task force. You know, I mean, we have to do it. All right, so Pickett, is it going to be Bernie or is it going to be Biden?
I think it's going to be very close at the top. I really do. I think it'll be Bernie Biden Warren.
Bernie Biden Warren. Okay. And between Pete and Amy, does Amy eclipse Pete?
You know, Pete is rising very fast.
Yeah.
And Amy's commercials have been, I think, pretty awful, horrible. I don't think she's getting much traction.
And on that note, Professor Stefan Schmidt, Dr. Politics. Next time we talk, we can figure out whether you called it right. Take care.
Great.
All right, ciao. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And we're going to end with Aretha. She's going to tell you to think. You better think before you go into that caucus.